They're all issued 45s, they're all issued morphine, and we were absolutely convinced that was it for both ships. And, you know, there comes a time in combat when it's your time, and, you know, you just have to accept that. And the Commodore and I accepted that except for one thing. If the establishment, the Washington establishment, the Pearl Harbor establishment, the 7th Fleet establishment, who have the same messages in hand we have, are not doing anything either to extract us or beef us up, what the heck is this all about? Unfortunately for us, that intelligence assessment was wrong, but you didn't know from foresight that it was wrong. We know from hindsight that for some reason that whatever the... I don't even know what the sources were for that intelligence assessment, but I know it was not a local assessment. It came from Washington. So everyone in the chain of command knew of that assessment. One of the things I did that night is I sent a message down to CTF 77 asking for continuous and massive air support. We got a sarcastic response. You've always had it, and you will continue to get it. Something along those lines. Totally uncalled for. We hadn't always had it. When we were up there, particularly at night, we would have 1A4 or 2A1s, and they'd go back to the carrier. You know, and it's time to go back for their recovery time. And where were their reliefs? They might show up a whole cycle later. North Vietnamese had an air defense network. They knew when we were covered and when we weren't. And besides, that coverage of one or two airplanes wasn't going to do much anyway. So, I don't know if the Washington establishment wanted us to put an exclamation point on this whole thing and make sure we had absolute, unequivocal public support. I don't know that. And I hate to guess it. But that's the only answer for the actions that night and that early morning. We resumed our patrol, came back out of the middle of the Gulf, went to where we were supposed to be, and steamed south, and nothing ever happened. I personally sat at the airscope that morning. You know, I'd been in bed for 8 days. It was kind of getting hard to focus on everything on it, but nothing happened.
At that time, you were still with Turner Joy, mm-hmm. and there was nobody else around.
A couple airplanes. A couple.
Berkeley was in the area, if I remember right.
No, she was a couple hundred miles away.
Okay. Were you a ship 45s on the second attack? Had you broken out the 45s before the 6th or 7th?
No.
Okay. And the morning?
Well, no. After the attack on the 2nd, we did.
Attack on the 2nd.
And I remember that clearly because when Turner Joy joined us, I remember a lot of the messages the Commodore sent to the Turner Joy, which essentially was to stay at Condition 3, be ready to go to General Quarters on the 2nd's notice that these people up here are mad. He didn't say why they were mad, he just that they're mad and they appear to want to attack us. Issue your officers 45s as part of that message. So we must have done it on Maddox by when Turner Joy joined us on the 3rd. But no, we'd never issued morphine before, and we did that morning.
Okay.
And just to show you the extent to which we really thought this was going to happen. Yeah, it just didn't. And I'm sure most of the officers and men on the Maddox had no idea what we knew, or we thought we knew. They didn't know why we issued morphine.
So you were issued 45s on the 2nd, but 45s and morphine on the 6th or 7th.
Morphine was added that night, the night that we... You know, the last day of patrol, and it's not clear in my mind whether that was the 8th or the 9th. We went in on the 31st, and it was 9 days, so I suspect it was the 8th. And I'm getting the nine days confused with the date tonight. I think it was the 8th. But it was our last day there. It was our last morning there. We were essentially out of harm's way by, say, 1500 that afternoon. But that morning, say, from 6:30 or 7 o'clock, first light that morning until noon or one, anything could have happened, and we expected it too. It just didn't.
What are your orders? What are your official orders when you're issued 45s in that situation?
You know, I'm going to tell you with 30 years' experience, I don't know what they are. I really don't. I mean, you know, back in the old day, I think it's tradition more than anything else. Now you're not going to shoot anything. You're not going to shoot an airplane out of the air with a 45. You're not even going to try. I think that's the officer's symbol of authority, like a baton is for some services. That's all it is. You know, I've seen movies where, you know, supposedly some enlisted guys need to know that maybe you'd shoot them if they don't follow your orders. But whether that's I don't know that that's the case, and I don't think I'd ever, myself, shoot somebody because he didn't obey my order. But if he thinks I might, that's fine with me.
Okay. Okay.
And I think it's a symbol of authority, and that's all. And tradition, I think that's all they are. Maybe I'm missing the boat, but my impression of it.
But most important is was that it wasn't clear cut for you. That there is no written down black and white reason why that happens.
Not that I'm aware of. There may be. I just don't know what that is.
Well, it wasn't made obvious to you. Anyway.
I think that's the only time in my career that I've had occasion to have a 45 strapped on around the clock.
Technical question on the four. When you had the one, when you had the skinhead that had stayed behind at the initial position, suspect.
Well, I'm not saying he stayed. See, one of the problems, well, it's not a problem, but it's a characteristic of electronic intercepts. You don't know how far, you know he's on this bearing. You just don't know how far along he is on that bearing. I mean, you can tell the difference between 200 miles and 50 miles because of signal strength. But you can't tell the difference between, say, 40 and 70 between because of signal strength.
But he was separated from the other three boats.
He had to have been because he didn't have the speed to catch us.
Okay, you knew that because of speed, not because
Well, I know. I knew that P-4s and P-6s had no radar capability. And I know the Swatow did, and I know that he didn't have the speed capability. So, you know, all those things fit together to tell you that.
And did you, certainly things all went to hell real quick after that, but did you ever know what happened to him? That never came up again.
We weren't worried about him anymore. We were only worried about the guys close to us that could shoot 37 millimeter at us, not 37 millimeter, but shoot machine guns at us and launch torpedoes. Torpedoes is a big worry, you know. The threat from a torpedo just cannot be overstated, especially today's torpedoes, which have very intricate homing capabilities. But even in those days, as we know from World War II, a hot, straight, normal aimed at the right point, you take one of those, I don't want to get into names and personalities, but there was one incident that I remember very clearly. That I remember because of the torpedoes. If you take a torpedo hit in a fire room, in particular, you've got these very hot boilers. And those are 600 pounders, but it doesn't make any difference on the Maddox. Very hot boilers, and you hit the exterior of that hot boiler with cold seawater all of a sudden, you're probably going to have another explosion, and that explosion is going to break you in half. The engineers during it was hot and humid, what you would expect in the Gulf of Tonkin. And July, August. And those were in the days where our engineering plants were not what they are. Well, we didn't have the engineering inspections in those days that we do now. And there's a lot of steam leaks here and there, and so there's high humidity in those spaces, and it's the steam causes both the humidity and the heat. It was very uncomfortable down there. We had guys passing out from heat exhaustion down there. Maddox did. They were, not my responsibility. They're Maddox's. But the Maddox's doctor was the staff doctor. And I was a JG, and he was a lieutenant. But he's a lieutenant, staff corps. And even though I was a JG, I was the only line officer on the Commodore's staff, so I was theoretically the chief of staff and functioned as the chief of staff. And he had asked me. He didn't know anything about warfare, as you expect a doctor wouldn't. And he's a young doctor, lieutenant. He's just doing his time. But he'd ask me what would happen. He would ask me about what happened if a torpedo hit. I said, well, depends on where it hits. And generally, you can take one or two hits. And, if your damage control is good, you can take a hit from a torpedo and survive it. If it hits the magazine, you're in trouble. If it hits the fire room, you're probably in trouble. And I told him about a boiler explosion. That was one thing. And a couple days later, we were having a heat exhaustion case. And it was after, I'm guessing this was probably the fourth or fifth, somewhere along there. And we were having heat exhaustion. And he refused to go down to the fire room to treat him. That was one time I was tempted to pull out my 45, but I just let it go. but I remembered it. And he subsequently wrote a book. I didn't pay much attention reading.
About the incident?
Yeah.
He wrote a book?
I've never encountered a book. I just read in some, maybe the proceedings or somewhere, I read that there was a book that he wrote. And I never bothered to run it down. I figured it has about as much validity as the Captain Kangaroo wrote it. So. This doctor, he got plenty of sleep, I'll tell you that. He didn't know what he probably didn't know where CIC was. He didn't know what it was. Well, how he could have written a book, I don't know.
Okay. Okay. I didn't know that. I'll be trying to track that down if I can. I'm trying to imagine how the if you knew then what you know now, I don't mean during the incident, but after the incident, you had 25 more years where you were supporting and defending a system which had more than just let you down, turn its tail and run on you. What do you think?
Well, let me respond to that first by saying it's not the system, and it's not the United States Navy, and it's not the United States government as a whole, and it's not the United States citizens that let me down. There's some individuals that let me down. You're always going to get some bad individuals. You don't indict the whole system. Because we were perhaps hung out to dry and not treated right during this whole honking mess by some individuals doesn't mean that the next time you're in this situation you're going to be treated the same by different people. From reading some of this, some people had their own agenda, including some people in uniform, had their own agenda. And I'm disappointed that if I get the impression, and I have somewhat gotten the impression, that several of these individuals were ready to sacrifice the officers and men on Maddox and Turner Joy to promote their agenda. And I'm disappointed in that. At least in the context of the way you do it, you know. But it's a dilemma to them. They can't tell Maddox to go in there and start attacking everything to provoke the North Vietnamese in order to get American public opinion to give the president a free hand. So you do this surreptitiously, I guess, but, you know, it's a great disservice to the people you have executing the plan for you. A good commander never sacrifices more than he has to. Never sacrifices anything, really. He has to abide some risks, and there's going to be casualties, but you do not preordain any casualty. You want to avoid every one of them you can. And to deliberately risk several ships, which may have been the case. You know, we could have accomplished the same things, certainly after we attacked the second. You know, adding another destroyer and occasional air support, that was gratuitous. There was no meaning.
Johnson called it doubling the naval presence and adding an air force, something like that. But he called it doubling the naval presence.
It's like a guy batting 050 was batting 100 all of a sudden, and we're supposed to celebrate it. That was baloney. And, you know, if we wanted to... One thing about ships, it's something that airplanes can't accomplish, it's something that submarines can't accomplish, it's something that Tomahawk missiles can't accomplish. And that's presence. Your mere presence. You can be seen. You're a military force, not necessarily a threat, but you're a military force that can be seen. Now, throughout the common thread in reading a lot of this is we wanted to show our presence and to show that they were not going to drive our presence away. And that's fine, I understand that way. Totally in conformance with our national goals and objectives. The United States is not going to be driven away from innocent passage, if you will, anywhere in the world. We just can't abide that. You cannot exercise the responsibilities we have in the world and accept that. But my God, if you want to show presence and you have a threat, let's show presence. I mean, the carriers Constellation and the Ticonderoga had a number of destroyers and a couple of missile boats. They didn't need all those. They needed a plane guard. They were not under any threat down there. What the hell was threatening them down at 16 North 110 East, Yankee Station? The traditional Yankee Station had lived for another 11 years almost. Nothing was threatening them down there. They didn't need the Berkeley and all these other ships that came out of Hong Kong with Constellation, the Sammy Moore and others. You want to show presence? Put 10 destroyers up there, including a couple of guided missile destroyers. I'll show them some presence. And then if they come out and attack you, you not only attack them back, you chase them into the damn harbor.
And to reiterate...
And if you do that, you violate their territory. So there's no such thing as violating somebody's territorial waters when he attacked you. That's a weird concept.
But you never knew you could do that after the second.
One, I didn't know we could do it. Two, the thought didn't cross my mind. Just because my mind doesn't work that way. To me, somebody smacks me in the face, there is no such thing as a sanctuary. You know, see, this is a concept that got to a real high level during Nixon's term. But Nixon bombed Cambodia, and the press and the Congress just thought that was horrible. Well, you're supposed to let the guy come over and attack you at night and then go back into Cambodia and have safe haven? To me, that's analogous to the guy from across the street comes over and rapes your wife and he goes back in his house and he's safe. And he's going to come back and rape your wife tomorrow night. This whole notion when you're in... Listen, war is not fought by some rules made up by lawyers somewhere. It just can't be. If the circumstances of the night of the 4th and the confusion that exists and the fact that this whole thing kind of evaporated, maybe earlier than we even thought it evaporated. I don't know. By evaporated, I mean, yeah, there wasn't anything left to shoot at and there was nothing left shooting at us. But it had been where we had our eyeballs on it and we had some certainty and I'd been the commander and I wasn't. And if I was going to get strung up tomorrow for doing it, if some guy came out and attacked my ship and he wounded one of my sailors, wounded one of them, there's no sanctuary for me. If they want to court-martial me tomorrow, fine. I don't even think of those terms. Maybe that's why I'm not an admiral. That's just the way it is. So, now, I'm just making the point that from reading this stuff, if you want to show them force, you want to do a show of force, do a show of force. And this notion that we're not to violate their territorial waters when our planes are bombing them. It's crazy. It's like MacArthur being told the bridges over the Yalu, he could bomb them, but he could only bomb the south half of the bridge. This whole thing started in Korea. This whole thing. I mean, you will not find any commander, responsible commander in any service who likes collateral damage. By collateral damage, I mean unintended casualties to civilians, primarily. But it's not avoidable. But look what we did during World War II. We dropped atomic bombs on two non-military targets. Killed tens of thousands of non-belligerents. I happen to disagree with that decision. I wasn't around to disagree with it, but I, you know, from hindsight, I think it was a horrible decision. But the point is that we did it. We firebombed Tokyo. We firebombed Dresden. Is that horrible? Of course it's horrible. Is it part of war? Yes. Is it a necessary part of war? We can argue. I would like to think it's not. But look where we went after World War II. All of a sudden, Korea, you know, bombed south half of the bridge. We get into what's a war in Vietnam. I mean, once you go to war, you go to war. I don't care whether Congress declares it or not. You go bomb the Red River dikes above Hanoi, and it's probably over. A lot of civilians, yeah. But do you tolerate 50,000 American dead in Vietnam? You tie our guys' hands? You send them over there with limited force, limited capabilities, limited crazy rules of engagement? A year after the Gulf of Tonkin, I was on a gunboat. Different ships. like the division, what was 192 became 132. And we had some different ships, McKean and a couple others, because I think we were on McKean at the time. And this whole thing about working in naval gunfire support, support of the Army, and in our case, it was the Marines up around Cape Batangan, south of Chulai. And this was crazy. You'd get a call for support from Marines being overrun, and you'd have to clear it with Saigon. And again, this was not the days of fast communications. And here you're, maybe the guy you played high school football with is over there being overrun. And all it takes is a few rounds for you. It's going to stop it, but you don't have authority to shoot it. Crazy way. Crazy way. Right. Everyone talks about the lessons of Vietnam, and really, generally when they talk about not getting involved in a quagmire, like maybe we're doing with Bosnia, but there are a whole bunch of lower level lessons which are equally important that I hope we don't lose sight of. If you're going to put American lives on the line, bring every bit of force short of nuclear weapons. Short of nuclear, I want to make that absolutely clear. We should never use nuclear weapons in Vietnam. I've never known any commander that advocated it, even tactical moves. But short of that, you do everything you can to avoid losing every American life. None of them. None of them. No American soldier's life is taken for granted. Or unnecessarily sacrificed. Got a little far afield from the Gulf of Tonkin.
Some ways, yeah. Sometimes. Some ways, maybe not, because it all applies. I think it all applies in the sense that can you sit here and say that in the same circumstances, in the future, somewhere along the line, we would make the same mistake that we made in the Gulf of Tonkin? Or the same agenda, whether they be mistakes or not.
Every time now I see some perhaps foreign policy objective of ours where the American people may not support it, and we put naval forces in proximity, I feel deja vu. And I'm just wondering if somebody's deliberately, again, deliberately manipulating and prepared to sacrifice. Well, Bosnia is really far afield, but my worry there is escalate. The thing about war, the thing about any conflict, war is the most severe of all conflicts, is that you get on the bottom rung of the ladder, and you can have every intention of staying on the bottom rung of the ladder. The problem is you can't control it. I don't care how powerful you are or how weak the other guy is. If he does something that causes you to have to get to the next rung, and then the next rung, you're not controlling your own destiny. And that's what worries me about Bosnia, the Serbs or anybody. Kills a few Americans, and then we have to retaliate in some form, and they retaliate, and everything. And the next thing you know, we're in another Vietnam. But I've not seen this in any of the public dialogue. To me, that's the biggest worry. It's uncontrolled escalation. We'll just have to see. Let's turn it off for a second, because I want to
nicely and focusing on the object very nicely. At that time, you should not apply the vanity.
One was sunk. Another one was dead in the water, burning, and a third one was damaged. I call them 1, 2, and 3. One was sunk or sinking. I visually observed that. And it was quite a way separated from the other two. The other two, one of them was burned, was burning, and the third was trying to help number two, and the third appeared to me to be damaged. And at that time, I rolled the F-8s. It turned out, I learned years later, that a second leader was the squadron commander, was Jim Stockdale. Subsequently, he was to write, in fact, the inflection of what he wrote in the chapter in the book that Ian Civil wrote, was essentially that his F-8 saved the Maddens. It's a bunch of crap. Again, one was sunk or sinking, another one was damaged and was dead in the water, and a third was helping him. I mean, it was over. I rolled it about the time I rolled the F-8s in for what I would call mop-up. and to give them a piece of the action, if you will. The thing was essentially over, and the F-8s did no damage that we could tell at all. In fact, they reported that they took a hit. You know, later we think that the hit was a ricochet off of one of their own 20 Mike Mikes back up into the wing of a wingman.
They'll never say that.
Well, probably not. But, they were, you know, if they'd have gotten there earlier, maybe they would have done all the damage. The point is, the surface action was done by the time the F-8s got there. And they wouldn't have participated at all, except they happened to be in the air when I called down to the Ticonderoga and told them we were under attack. It was my understanding they were just up for normal bumping, you know, playing. After all, these were F-8s. They were fighters. They were not attack aircraft. They were not suited for this kind of work. So the fact that, you know, it says earlier in this article, Ticonderoga was there specifically in support of DeSoto ops, maybe, but that was completely unknown to me, and I suspect the Commodore Herrick does. Tycho was down there, and Tycho was running the old, started out as Yankee team ops. They were doing surveillance over Laos. Air surveillance, and that was it.
And if that were the case, that they were there, as he says in the article, it would have been unconscionable for you not to know that as ops officer.
Well, more than that. If they were there in support of us, I should have had an airplane. I should have had all their frequencies. I mean, this is just the way we operate. If airplanes are going to support surface ships or vice versa, we know how to communicate with each other. We know when each other's going to be on station and what our roles and missions are. None of that exists. What really happened here is these events happened in quick sequence. The action was over except for Moffat. The F-8s were rolling in. And a message was received, and I don't remember if it was from Com 7th Fleet or from St. Pat Fleet, in response to my initial message, which said we were being approached. My memory said pursued, but whatever. Their immediate flash response was to essentially, to paraphrase, it was to defend yourself, but if they break it off, you break it off. Well, all these things happened almost coincidentally. And when the F-8s finished their one pass and I sent them back, the Admiral Moore, and I'm pretty sure it was him personally on this HF radio circuit we had, and I was on our end, said that he was sending a number of other airplanes, sending them up there, and he wanted to sink them all.
From Ticonderoga.
Yeah, the Admiral on Ticonderoga. And I'm listening to him with one hand and reading this, if they break it off, you break it off, message from higher authority. And again, I don't remember what it was, concept leader, think back, but higher authority than Admiral Moore in event. And he subsequently, maybe 10 minutes later, we talked again on the radio, and apparently he'd just been handed the message too, and so he did not send that secretary or whatever he was going to send. And the reason that we did not, Lyndon Johnson later was supposedly incensed that this destroyer couldn't sink three little, quote, little PT boats. Well, we got the message. I mean, we could have easily sunk them. It was just a mop up there. It would have been target practice. It would have been unnecessary, except for maybe political reasons. We could have taken prisoners. It would have all been very easy. But we didn't do it. Because we were told if they broke it off, we broke it off. Now, they didn't break it off voluntarily, but we were broken off by the fact that it was over.
Which is why he changed the rules of engagement for the second, by the time of the second attack. The president himself.
To what?
Search and destroy. Pursuit.
Oh, yeah. Well.
If attack, pursuit.
It's easy to change the rules of engagement and say that, but I will tell you, and I think I have my share of aggressiveness. I think I have a reputation for it, as a matter of fact. But when you're up in the Tonkin Gulf, you are surrounded on three sides by hostile or potentially hostile forces, in the case of the Chinese mainland and Hainan Island, and your nearest support is 300 miles away, approximately, at Ticonderoga initially. And you're talking about a minimum of a half hour flight time response, and we're not at war. You've got to understand when you're at war, the rules change. When you're at war with a country, it's your mission to seek and destroy. But we weren't even sure why it happened, much less did we think we were in a state of war, or that we had carte blanche to go. Historically, peacetime rules of engagement are you're limited to defending yourself. Now this follow them into their ports and blow them up in their homes is, you know, it sounds good in rhetoric, but it's not very practical.
It served the president a good purpose on the fourth for the
I always resented that, you know, Lyndon Johnson quoted all over the place, and I didn't see his quotes until I got home months later. Because my wife had saved all the papers and the Time and Newsweek and all that stuff. That he said that. And the St. Pack fleet or his staff officer, whoever did it, didn't step up to the bat and say, well, he didn't do it because we told him not to do it. You know, we were classic scapegoats.
And I don't have a word to that effect. I have every word Lyndon Johnson's probably said in those 3 days in here. And you're right. None of that ever came up.
You know, there's something in here about one aircraft was hit, the F-8, and you had to bingo to Da Nang. Okay, it says 339 was sunk, 336 was heavily damaged. That's in consonance with what I said. The third one made it back. And here it says Admiral Johnson, 7th Fleet, ordered a second flight not to pursue. That's kind of cutting the corner there, actually. What happened is we both got the message just saying to break it off, but they broke it off. Did I lose the page?
I may not have copied everything. It wasn't pertinent. 16.
That's okay. Not continuity between.
The other thing is, okay, 61. We'll go 61, 62. Sorry. Power copies.
This guy claiming that 339 wasn't sunk years afterwards is baloney. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it was sunk.
Visuals, he said it was towed in by the other remaining craft.
The second boat, the damaged boat, which in this article is identified as 336, might have been towed back by 333. I don't know. We left the area. But I think if you talk to people who were on the bridge, and again, I was 80% of my time was in CIC and radio and not that much time on the bridge. I really went to the bridge only to talk to the Commodore to say, I'm sending this message of what do you want me to tell the world now? But it's my memory is that one of them was sunk, and I saw it was sunk in one of my trips to the bridge. See, I said something before about, you know, you feel lonely up there, particularly, you know, I can tell you unequivocally that if it's my mission, we're at war with somebody, it's my mission to go in somewhere with my ship, no matter what the odds, my mission, it's clear what my mission is, my mission is to inflict as much damage on them and as it's the least on my crew and me, my ship, I have no problem with that philosophy. But you see, we didn't have that mission, that did not exist. You know, this thing about Captain Herrick expressing concern for the safety of the force. You know, if we're up there to do something, let's get the adequate forces up there and let's do it. Or tell us to go ahead and... But when you always got to wait for the other guy to fire the first shot, and you're fairly confident he's going to fire the first shot, that's just not an untenable position to be in.
But that, isn't he reflecting there the same concern that you had earlier about being out there on Maddox instead of on Berkeley?
No, actually Maddox, the 5-inch 54 is on Turner Joy, or on, same as Berkeley. If we'd had Berkeley, they'd put out a couple more rounds a minute, and perhaps the system's a little more accurate. But Berkeley only had two gun barrels to bear. On Maddox, we had six. This is all from hindsight. For surface action against PT boats, Maddox turned out probably the better. The only reason I bring up the Berkeley Maddox issue is that, you know, was it going in, did they deliberately take us off of a new missile destroyer and put us on an old World War II destroyer because there was concern that the ship and its crew would be lost and it was better to lose the Maddox than the Berkeley.
Because you were physically in Berkeley.
We were physically on Berkeley when we were given the tasking for the patrol. And you know, if it was higher authority, whether it's at the MACV level, SINCPAC fleet level, DOD level, JCS level, president, whatever the level is, if they felt that there was risk to the Maddox, and the indicators now from hindsight and on reflection immediately after it, I think they did feel that way. You know, you owe it to your crew. You owe it to people you sent in harm's way to tell them they're in harm's way. Don't tell them it's some kind of routine baloney. Not only because they'll be better prepared if they know they're going in harm's way. Theoretically, they shouldn't, but in practicality, they will. But during the Cold War phase, and knowing that in our lifetime, almost every war the United States has been involved in has been precipitated by a naval action. When you get involved in something like this, and there are nuclear weapons on both sides, and you know you can't control escalation necessarily, you don't want to be the guy that's responsible for pulling the trigger, making a mistake and pulling the wrong trigger that escalates into something that bad. And this is all playing in the back of your mind, even when you're in a little seemingly insignificant incident like this. Why are these guys attacking us? You know, what did we do? And more importantly, what are the ramifications of this?
And you had no... Well, I'll pause.
Go ahead.
At Key Lung, what did they tell you? What was the scope of things that's not SI? I mean, I'm focusing here on what they didn't tell you, but my gosh, what did you leave the... What were you left as an impression of what was you were going into?
It's going to be a routine DeSoto patrol. Now, let me define that. I've personally been on one before, on a 2100. I think I did it under Pritchett when I was an ensign and the CIC officer. It was off of Tsingtao. And, of course, I read about a lot of other ones. And it was a routine occurrence. It was intelligence gathering around the communist, the peripheral communist countries there. And generally, you took fingerprints of their radars with your WLR-1 intercept gear, so we knew which radars were, and you tried to triangulate and locate exactly where those radars were. You did a lot of oceanographic stuff. In case you ever had to do ASW in those waters, you wanted to know what the typical water inversions were and what the salinity was and all that stuff. And you did counts of traffic, even fishing jumps. It was all rather mundane intelligence, if you will. That's what DeSoto patrols did. Probably more importantly, DeSoto patrols were there to challenge the excessive territorial limits claimed by these countries. And I don't know this, I'm a lawyer, but I've been told over the years that it's necessary we do this from time to time because the world court, if somebody makes a claim of, say, 200 miles territorial waters and it's never challenged, in fact, becomes de facto eventually. And we do this routinely. I did it routinely in the mid-80s with the Enterprise Battle Group. We went through Lombok Strait in Indonesia without notifying them deliberately. It wasn't insult them. It's just to say this is an international strait, and we're not going to notify you for routine operations.
Would you have known in this case that there was a record of communist country considering bays, taking that 3-mile limit out from the edge of the bay? I mean, where the two lands come together, all the bay area is there,
yeah,
is an inland
debated,
water.
Yeah, it's been debated, but I have never knew that, for instance, the Gulf of Tonkin was going to be considered to be subject to something like that.
You didn't know that.
No. The point is that, you know, mariners have to have the right of innocent passage, and if we didn't have that, Singapore Strait could be closed to political activity, and so could the Sunda Strait and Lombok Strait. Onto the southern Indian Ocean. So could Tsushima and all the straits up north around Japan. So, you know, it's necessary to challenge these from time to time. And I know this article says we were told we could go within 5 miles, and you know, my memory is 12 miles from the coast and 4 or 5 miles from the islands, like Honmei and Honmat, 3 or 4 to 5, something like that. And I'm confident we were very diligent about not going getting inside, because while they claim these excessive limits and we claim 3 off the United States, we generally recognize 12, and we don't want a legal challenge for that one. So we were very diligent, reasonably confident we never got inside 12 miles of the coast. It was either 3, 4, or 5 in the islands, whatever had been stipulated.
Most of the press reports were saying 30 on the first attack and 60 on the second.
What, our distance from the coast? Yeah, but you see, that's not the distance we started at. We were within, as I recall, when those three PTs identified near as 330, 36, and 9, when they came around from the other side of Honmei, or Honmat, it was Honmei, I think. Those two islands are right near each other there. We visually saw them, so we were. We were then 7 or 8 miles at most from the islands at the time. The actual attack happened about 30 miles from the coast, simply because we took off at flying speed to open the distance. And there have been Navy professionals and others, Lyndon Johnson hinted at it, that this was not bravery or whatever, right? like we were running away. Actually, the intent was to buy time to report to the world. Again, this was in a time of not just great communications, not like we always picking up the red phone and going by satellite to tell St. Clair, oh, by the way, Admiral, this is what's happening right now. We did have a dedicated CW circuit to Vietnam, State Bill, and through them to Hawaii and the rest of the world. But it
won.
Did it, you know.
And things were incredibly backed up very quickly.
Yeah, and because we had to get it out fast, all this went out in the clear. These were the days of the old crypto machines. We had to set everything, and you know, it took you a half hour to get the machine ready, and then you had to type in, then you had to back check it. It would have taken an hour to get off that message we were being attacked. So we sent it. And again, many times those messages came out of my mouth, and the radio man wrote down the draft by memory later. Maybe accurate, maybe not. Of course, whoever received the message wrote it down, so it would be a more accurate source for what was actually said. But no, we, back to your question, what happened in Key Lung, we went in there to load the van and its people. The Commodore, Oger, and I, and probably others, I just don't remember what others, or how many others, went to Key Lung. We went to what was then called Taiwan Defense Command Headquarters. It was a 3-star, and I don't remember his name, the one then. And his other hat was Commander of Patrol Force of the Pacific Fleet, which was logical because most of the patrols were done in the Taiwan Straits. As I recall, the Admiral was not there. I didn't read any significance into that or out of that. I don't know who Commodore Herrick or Captain Oger met with, separate from me. I know at the level of the one-on-one briefing I got from one of the staff officers, I was told, you know, there were 34 Alpha Ops, and I said, what are they? You know, I had an SI clearance. I was told that it was beyond my clearance level. And I remarked at the time, how can I not interfere with someone I don't know what it is?
And only Herrick, Oger, and yourself were SIs. Is that right?
That's correct. This was in the days before, you know, we got to the point, I guess, in the late 70s, early 80s, where most naval senior officers were routinely SI, in case you had to deal with any of that information. But in the 60s, outside the intelligence community, it was unusual for anyone to have an SI clearance. And those SI clearances were done on all three of us in about a week. And they were done from the interval from when we were selected by 7th Fleet or whomever to do the patrol, and the time we were in Key Lung. It's an expanded top secret background investigation.
It's above an SBI. You would have had an SBI and then something additional, I'm guessing, for that level.
No, you've got you've got enough to have a top secret. That's already in your record, you know, all your background investigation and everything.
Yeah, yes.
And then the SBI is an expanded BI. Mm-hmm. And normally you fill out a bunch more forms, but this was done by message. So it was a hurry-up SBI, and it was only done on the three of us. I clearly remember who did and did not have access to SI information during that patrol. Perry, Bozier, and I. And of course,
the radio,
the band did.
What was your relationship to the convent? Were you operations officer for the convent?
No, the van operated as a separate unit. Of course, they were getting power and everything from us. As I recall, they used a couple of our radios, the Maddox's radio circuits, although they did have an organic capability. But the officer in charge of that van, as I recall, was a lieutenant. I don't remember his name. I think the command relationship was he reported to the Commodore through me.
But any of the information you were cleared to get wasn't coming from that van. Yes. Okay.
Oh, here I am.
There you are. Yeah, I thought you were in this one.
The watch officer had already completed the maneuver, had already evaluated the maneuvers. Yeah, I'm going to have to show you some, I'm going to draw some diagrams for you that, to me, make a compelling case that I got to go back to where this started here. See, there's some things in here that I didn't know. And again, I'm surprised I've not read this article. I haven't been a subscriber to the proceedings for a long time.
You know you're welcome to come.
Com 7th Fleet said that the DeSoto patrols ended after the 5th, and Admiral Moore overrode him. You believe we could possibly draw the enemy away from 34 Alpha? Well, Admiral Moore, if you read this, and I'm quoted, I'm going to tell you something. If you're using the Maddox as bait, and you're using me as bait, God has at least let me know that was my mission, to be bait. The section that says that in the very start, that the Ticonderoga was specifically directed to provide air cover for the Maddox. That may be so, but as a division operations officer, I was totally unaware of that. You know, I knew Ticonderoga was down there, and I called him when we were under attack. It was the first time we communicated with the Ticonderoga since we've been in the area. Until then, the only time. So maybe Ticonderoga knew it. I didn't know it. Maybe the Commodore knew it, but I didn't know it.
And if that is the case, if they did know it, that's a big breakdown in communication somewhere.
Well, that would indicate that someone, some level, thought that we were vulnerable to attack. But we on the Maddox were not told that. Maybe they didn't want us to think we were, so they didn't tell us Ticonderoga was ready to support us. I didn't call Ticonderoga. We were not in their chain of command. We were not in the same task organization. They were just another naval force in the area that I happened to know was in the area, and it was communications plan I knew. So that's why we called them. Going to what's written in this article, and we can go in more depth later, with respect to the night attack. Oh, my memory's a little hazy on some sequencing. I think that's all it's hazy on. Yeah, I want to tell you my perspective of how this thing happened. First of all, because of the attack on the 2nd, and when Turner Joy joined us, we were told that we did not have to stay close to the coast at night. And this is particularly significant because, regardless of a ship's size and capability, if you're steaming in and around a lot of junks, for example, or small craft, or even merchant vessels, for that matter, where the enemy can lurk, and he gets to shoot at you first, all your advantage has been overcome. And there were large drug concentrations there. I mean, at any given time, day and night, we probably had 100 junks in sight. And we came very close to a lot of them. And some of those were large enough that a PT boat could have been right alongside on the other side. We wouldn't even have seen him. And we could have passed it and all of a sudden had a torpedo with no time to react. So that's bad enough in the daytime. In the nighttime, you don't want it at all. And I'm reminded that the first night we went into the Gulf, before any of us had any idea this was going to happen, the Commodore was particularly jumpy because, unlike I, he had served in the Korean War. And he said a favorite trick of the North Koreans was to load a junk up with dynamite and get it in alongside you and either sacrifice themselves or what. But he was very leery of being around all these junks in this kind of an environment, and particularly at night. So after the attack happened on the second, and as I recall, we initiated it. We said we wanted to go seaward at night to be clear of all these junk formations. We went a night steam, and our original prescribed track had been cut off. We weren't any more going all the way up there. We were going to be all patrolled in the vicinity of Hanmei and Hanmat the rest of the time. And we wanted a night steam out 30, 40 miles out, so it was in clear waters, and if anything came near us, we could see it. And we did get permission to do that, and we did it on the night of the 3rd. We went to a particular area that I would call 40 miles due east of, say, Hanmei, out in the open sea. Open sea is different than Gulf of Tonkin. And when we started out there on the 4th, at some point in time, we saw on surface search radar that there were 3 or 4 contacts in the area, same exact area that we night steamed the night before. And these contacts were, over time, we tracked them and they were dead in the water. You know, they might have been going 2 or 3 knots in circles, but on the radar, you essentially tracked them staying in the same area. And we figured that it was a trap laid for us out there, that they were sitting out there waiting for us. And at the same time, we got an intercept, an electronics warfare, ELINT, if you will, intercept from a skinhead radar out there. Skinhead or pothead, I don't remember, it's not clear, but these are small navigational radars that are on the SWAT out. They're not on the PT. They're not on the PT boats that participated in the attack. They have no radars. So we knew there was a bad guy sitting there. And we knew there were 3 or 4 or more of them. And we were pinging that meaning the radar, and they were dead in the water.
3 or 4 more of them right there?
Yeah, right there.
Okay.
And we detected them for about 20 miles, and we had correlating electronics intercept at the time. So we knew these were not fishing junk. At least one of them wasn't a fishing junk. It was a bad guy. Or what we determined had been bad. And so we, instead of proceeding right on into that, after we decided it was a trap, there was a conversation between Oger and myself and Eric and maybe others. I don't remember whether those others were involved. We were in a column formation at the time, Maddox in the lead, Turner Joyce stern, probably 2,000 yards. And we decided that we would go southeast. We thought we were about to be attacked again. It was dark. And I want to say something about darkness, because this will lead to why Stockdale and I diverged so much. And I've had many years at sea. I know of which I speak. On a very dark night, it is virtually impossible to see something on the water unless it looms above a horizon and it's backlighted some way, whether it's a starlight or moonlight or something. If you can't see something with your naked eyes, when it's a dark night, you've got to have the moon, you've got to have something. And this was a dark night. There was no light out there that night. The accounts in the papers of thunderstorms and raging seas have been embellished. There may have been a thunderstorm in the area. I didn't personally observe it, but the seas were fairly flat, as they almost always are up there, except when a typhoon goes through. The point here is, just because you didn't see something with your eyeballs on a dark night, particularly when you consider that you're on a ship, you're elevated. Most of the people on the lookouts, everyone else, even the people in gun mounts are elevated, and you're looking down on the water. These PT boats are smaller than you are. So unless they have some kind of light on them, you're not going to see them.
because you're looking into. Now, you take a guy like Stockdale up there in an F-8 who has no electronic sensors whatsoever. He has no radar. He has only his eyeballs. And he says because he didn't see anything with his eyeballs, it didn't happen. Oh, I didn't see anything with my eyeballs either, but I sure saw a lot of electronic stuff. And another difference between Stockdale, I had access to information that he didn't then, and I suspect never has had access to, which is really a clincher. So anyway, on this dark night, and knowing those contacts were there and having electronic intercept confirmation that there was at least one bad guy there, we...
Can I borrow one of the pieces of paper?
Anything here?
Here's a close to not a very good depiction, and here's, say, Han Man. And we're out here at about, say, 20, 30 miles going that way. And call them, and here's these contacts. We figured it was a trap, so we did a column movement and started heading southeast, say 135, 140, somewhere in there. The carriers are way down here, and we immediately sent out flash messages to the world, now including the carriers, because now they were supporting us, or we felt they were. We had turned, and we felt this trap was happening here. And for maybe the first 3 or 4 miles of this journey southward, southeastward at 30 knots, these guys stayed in their same geographic position.
What time is this, Kenton?
I don't remember.
Or daylight?
No. This is after dark. The times, probably, I am not in a position to dispute any of the times in here.
Okay.
This said things started happening at about... 2100, something like that.
8:30. Okay.
Well, we sent a message about 8:30 saying we had, according to this, that we had received information.
Okay.
And that's the other part of the puzzle here. Well, after we'd gone maybe 10 miles down this track, these guys all of a sudden, these guys who were later called birds that I would remind the listener, the reader, that have radars mounted on them that we can intercept, all of a sudden went on parallel, slightly closing tracks, and these birds, which had been in orbit and observed in orbit in one position for some 30 minutes, maybe as much as an hour, all of a sudden going at 50 knots, which just coincidentally happens to be the top speed of P4s and P6s. As we proceed down here, eventually, two or three of them, as I recall, got to a position because they could outrun us. They caught us. And here's Maddox in the lead. Turner Joyce behind us, 1,000 yards. They get maybe 4 miles off the equidistant on the track of Maddox's bow. And then all of a sudden, they all of the... If you could get a hold of the plot on the DRT, which gives you a true picture, you'll see all of those boats turn, those birds, turn right at us, and almost coincident. Exactly. Now, this is all radar. We had radar and electronic intercept before. Now we have radar throughout this. And by the way, we're still getting the electronic intercept where before it was on this bearing to that skinhead or pothead. Now it's on this bearing. So he stayed up here. One or more of them stayed up here. Or at least didn't close at the rate that the P4s and P6s did. That's why I think their tactic was to use the radar to vector the little guys. But almost coincident, within 30 seconds of seeing on the DRT the plot of this turn toward our bow, for the first time, there were hydrophone effects in the water on that bearing. Hydrophone effects come from torpedoes.
For the first time.
Coincident with this turn. They turned and they launched torpedoes. Mm-hmm. Well, after that first torpedo was launched, I think that the Commodore, one of us sent out a message telling both ships, because they were under our tactical control right here. We told both ships the maneuver was necessary. Then the fog of war is caused with what sets in. And it sets in for 2 to 3 hours. It was mass confusion. I've seen it written that that Maddox almost shot Turner Joy out of the water. Some gunner's mate onto Maddox made himself a hero. I don't know if that happened or not. There were reports coming from various people on the Maddox. I see this. Shortly after this happened, airplanes arrived on the scene. One of them, Stockdale. Oh, I didn't know who he was at the time much. I didn't even know he was a squadron commander up there. I knew his call sign, don't remember it. But we had F-8s up there, A-4s and A-1s. Maybe we're fortunate we didn't have any mid-airs. I don't know. Maybe we're fortunate Maddox didn't shoot Turner Joy or vice versa. And on reflection, after it was all over, a lot of the hydrophone effects that were reported subsequent to that were probably not really hydrophone effects, but there were bubbles put in the water by going 30 knots at hard rudder, or knuckles put in the water. And sometimes you can get some beat off of them. So probably, I don't remember how many torpedoes we reported that night. It was probably, from hindsight, grossly exaggerated. But I know one thing. The first one wasn't. Absolutely the first one. How do I know it? Well, I've got a radar contact that makes this turn toward me, and I get a hydrophone effect on the same bearing almost, you know, within seconds.
But wouldn't you have that with a knuckle bubble knuckle?
Who put the knuckle there?
The boat turning.
Oh, no, you need a deeper draft.
You do.
See, we're getting them off Turner Joy. Turner Joy's getting them off of us. He wouldn't have come from that boat. That was, and this report alludes to Old Reed or Sonarman. We probably had that. I mean, it was mass compute. And as far as the aviators up there, I do not know if Stockdale himself ever called into his microphone on one of our frequencies that I see it in your wake or whatever. I don't know if he did it. He says he never did. But I know that some of them did it.
Some of them saw something.
Some of them saw something, and they were later to deny it all. Why, I don't know. But that night, when I was in combat, I was watching the DRK. I was trying to keep, and I kept running the radio, which was only a few paces away. I don't recall going to the bridge and have my eyeballs on the night at all. That night, I think it was totally between radio and CIC, and that was the night the messages went out fast and furious, and most of them were not drafted. As soon as I walked into radio, Weaver was on the CWP.
And this, you saw one of those torpedoes on the night attack, or was it the second?
I didn't physically, no, on the 2nd of August. I personally, visually, saw one of the torpedoes. It came very close down the side of the map. It's not dangerously close, but this is where they had no homing capability. Mm-hmm. But when you put everything together, and I will tell you again, I was an experienced CIC/operations officer. When this started, I've gotten a lot more experience over the years, and I would change none of my judgments or evaluations of what I saw and the conclusions I reached that night. People said this was birds. Again, birds don't have radars. Birds do not orbit, and then when you turn away from headed toward them, all of a sudden decide they would like to accompany you. Birds don't come to what is a classic torpedo launching position and then execute the classic torpedo launching maneuver, and then cause hydrophone effects in the water. I mean, to call for people to, and when you look on a radar, I've seen flocks of birds on a radar. Occasionally you see them, not often. It has to be a pretty concentrated flock to get a return. I mean, they've got to be a bunch of them. They're going to be flying fairly close together, but the returns kind of fuzzy. It's like it is on a cloud. And then it disperses, and it's a very sporadic thing. We held almost continuous contact on these all the way through. They were not fuzzy. They exhibited maneuvering characteristics. And it's just, I need, to satisfy me 100%, I need nothing other than what I personally saw that night. What I personally saw was those radar contacts where we'd been the night before. I personally saw the intercept and evaluated the intercept on the WLR-1 at that pothead or skinhead radar. I personally observed the track of these contacts coming after us. And I, strange as it seems, I personally heard the hydrophone effects, because when the sonarman in a different location put his key down on the 29MC to announce it, you could hear him behind him coming over his gear. We both executed radical maneuvers, and from then on, who shot what, how many, God knows. I really don't know.
You were on the 29MC with sonar.
29 MC is a way to communicate directly outside of South Town Power phones from sonar to CIC.
Sonar to CIC. Okay.
Well, under the bridge.
And the sonar men you had on board were, did you know them? Did you work with them? Okay.
No, they were ship's calls. I personally know any of them.
Okay. And the contact that you saw on here, was there any other clutter out there on the screen at all? So these came across clear?
No, but later on when the airplanes got there, that's when it seemed, you can see an airplane on surface search radar if he's flying low. Well, we had a lot of low-flying airplanes later. It is, in my judgment, blessed with hindsight and a lot more experience, it is an absolute miracle. I mean, we were shooting star shells. That's a vertically elevated barrel. We had airplanes all over the place. Nobody was really coordinating anything. It was my job, but it was mass confusion, and I didn't have the tools to do all that. I didn't have the modern systems we have now. But it is an absolute miracle that neither ship shot each other, and we didn't shoot down any of our planes, or our planes didn't have midairs. I suppose they were all operating at different altitudes.
In that next 2 or 3 hours, you were doing everything, basically. That would have been compass, trying to run an arrow.
I was trying to be a jack of all trades, but I couldn't be the master of any at that point.
Okay.
But until that first torpedo was shot, I was virtually glued to what was happening. I mean, there was no confusion at all until the first torpedo caused the first maneuver and we operated independently. From then on, I tried to keep track of where Turner Joy was, but I wasn't given orders to Maddox of who could they, what bearings they could shoot on or couldn't shoot on. It was impossible to keep track of the radar of the airplanes because they were within the minimum range of the SPS 40 air search on the Maddox. Sometimes they showed up on surface radar, sometimes they didn't, depending upon what profile and what altitude they were doing. But I heard, and I was not controlling any of them. You know, they were air controllers on the Maddox, OSs that were talking to the airplanes. But one of them's surface was on a speaker. And I heard, distinctly heard, I see one in your wake, and I distinctly heard another time, there's one there.
And who's on that circuit that you were just talking about? This is with Turner
Joy? There was probably in those days, they called a fleet air defense circuit, was used to control airplanes.
Okay.
Talk between airplanes and ships.
And you're, as you're sitting in CIC...
I don't think I sat that night, but that's okay.
I think you sat for a long time. You didn't have contact with the sonarman. Sonarman's physically in another part of the ship. So at the time that you're seeing this turn, this maneuver, this torpedo maneuver...
The sonarman did not see that turn.
See, he didn't see that turn, but he called just at the same time.
Yeah.
Calling
that. There was no correlation internally. I mean, it wasn't as if a sonarman said, you know... He sees the turn, he expects to hear a torpedo,
exactly.
And therefore he hears one because he expected to hear one.
Exactly. Okay.
Now, after that, after he'd heard the first one, he or them, however many there were, they probably expected to hear a lot more, and maybe they did hear a lot more because they expected. But that case cannot be made for that first. And it could have been multiple torpedoes the first time. I just could hear the hydrophone.
How much time was there between the between here and here?
A couple hours.
Couple of hours. Okay. And
that's an estimate on my part based on my memory now. The time, there's some time stuff in here.
Yeah. Okay.
I have no reason to dispute.
Okay.
But when we get to, you know, and after it was all over, there were no more contacts to shoot at, maybe because some had withdrawn, a couple had been sunk, it's my understanding, a couple were sunk. The airplanes had bingoed back, and I don't recall now whether we had another launch coming or we didn't, that we had then canceled. Anyways, calm was restored finally, and I mean calm from the most hectic environment I think I've ever been in for those couple of hours. And the Commodore called me in his cabin. Captain Oger was there. And, you know, a lot of messages going back out. About every 5 or 10 minutes, I ran into radio and sent another one. 4 torpedoes fired, 3 night. I don't even remember everything I sent. And a lot of it wasn't even recorded on our end. And he had, as you've seen in some of these documents, he had some severe reservations. And he made the point, he's the one that, I have never personally heard a hydrophone effect
generated by a rudder at high speed. Never personally heard one of those. But apparently he and Ian Osier, and both of them were, have been Naval Academy instructors or book weapons types, experts in that area. No, he was disputed. He said a lot of that we generated ourselves. And at the time, you know, he drafted this message. He wanted me to, he told me to go in and send this message. And it was a message that's been quoted a lot. There's one that cast doubt. We cast it out. We're the ones. Commodore Herrick is the one who cast doubt on it all happening. He was the first one to cast it out. But, no, this is certainly not. I'm not criticizing Commodore Herrick. He didn't know what, you know, this is, what the heck is this going to cause? Let's make sure we're absolutely sure before we cause something drastic to happen. And he was just being cautious. But he, boy, did he get slammed for it. And I'll get into that more in a minute. But I tried to make the point at the time. Commodore, I don't know, there was a lot of confusion for the last couple of hours, no doubt about it. I don't think anyone can say with any certainty how many boats were there, who shot at whom, who sunk who.
We're unequivocal. Unequivocal.
I made the point at the time, and I'm just as certain today as I was then, that, that at least one torpedo was shot at us. Probably more. They can come out there to shoot just one once they got in position. How many more and how many boats after we started getting the multiple contacts, a lot of which were airplanes? Some of them was weather return. I really don't know. But I know that those boats were not weather return. They were not birds. And everything put together very nicely and neatly. No question about that.
And for the record, we've done this before. Let me get into how you knew that. You had 5 years enlisted as an electronics tech, working on SPS-10?
Working on SPS-10s, SPS-40s.
Okay. And you went from there, picked up a commission, and at your...
I didn't just work on those. I, on my own, stood watches in CIC.
So you worked on them and operated them. You knew the nuances of them inside and out. You know the difference between a bird and a ship. Up there.
Absolutely.
You're the operations officer for the division, and you're reading the scopes probably better than anyone else on that ship.
I wouldn't go so far as to say that. In that era, as I've discussed with you before off the record, officers tended not to get their hands dirty. You know, I hate to use that expression, but, you know, enlisted people operated things, and enlisted people made reports to officers. Officers evaluated those reports and did what they did. But I've always been a hands-on guy. I was enlisted. I was, my first 2 years at sea as an officer was the electronics maintenance officer, and then CIC officer on a 2100 destroyer. And frankly, a surprise to everybody that a lieutenant junior grade went to the division. I relieved the lieutenant commander. And the guy selected for lieutenant commander relieved me. So I was essentially ahead of myself in this tour. But I'd had a lot of experience on radars. So.
Because your capability was recognized.
I suppose.
You can say it. It's okay. Everyone else seems to know. And your surface warfare specialty, by the time you had retired, was what?
Command and control.
So you were a command and control officer. And they had wanted you to do what before you retired?
I was slated to be the commanding officer of the Fleet Combat Direction School in Point Loma.
Okay, which was basically going to overhaul NTDS.
Well, an overhaul was teaching people how to use it. We would have been involved in upgrades to it, and also was very involved in teaching flight staffs, battle group commander staffs, how to use the tools and the tactics that were available to them.
And why were you slotted for that position instead of...
I had a unique capability in that area.
Okay. They recognized your excellence in that area, where you had been slated to return to sea as a cruiser and a battle wagon.
No, we had it reversed there. I was put on the shore list for that job. If I had not opted to retire, I had an opportunity to get shifted to the C list, but it would have been a personal favor type opportunity.
Okay, I see. Okay.
And I didn't do that. One of the reasons I didn't do it was it would have meant somebody else would have gotten a personal opportunity to go from the C list to the short list and probably wouldn't have liked that.
What an opportunity.
Okay. But back to what Herrick wrote, you know, I respect why he did it. I didn't agree with him. I won't say I didn't agree with him. I didn't agree with the flavor that one could read into that message, that because a lot of what we reported may not have happened, therefore none of it happened, which is the conclusion a lot of people have. I agree a lot of what we reported did not happen, or at least it didn't happen in the way we perceived it as happening because of the confusion at the time. But that didn't negate the events leading up to the first torpedo. That all clearly happened, and there's been never any doubt in my mind that I understand Admiral Stockdale, for instance, claiming it didn't happen because he didn't see it, but I didn't see it either, and I had tools available to me Admiral Stockdale did not have. The fact that because he didn't see something on a dark night, and what is dark, water is dark at night, by the way, and these boats were operating with no lights on. And you'd be insane if you're driving a PT boat against a big ship, even one of your absent radar. Your advantage is not being, you're being able to see them above the horizon, and they're looking down into the water. They can't see you. Now, we had one Marine guy on board the Maddox that said he saw a real dim light go around us. I suspect that was on a compass, a real, you know, really dim down light, if he saw that. A lot of the reported sightings from people on Turner Joy, I don't know whether they're true or not. I have no idea. No idea. The Commodore Herrick laid the groundwork for the doubt. Again, I'm not critical of that. And I would just state for the record, too, that my perception, and again, this is my perception at the time, and bulwarked by a lot of experience since then, including having served in the same grade he was in at the time and had the same responsibilities. The treatment of Commodore Herrick by the Navy was absolutely atrocious. I mean, absolutely atrocious. Let me give you some examples. After that attack, now I might be slightly off on the time, but it was either after the second attack, but I'm pretty sure it was after the fourth attack. We were low on fuel, and here we are running around 30 knots. Both ships were low on fuel. And by low, by tradition, the Navy, we don't like to get below 50% because you don't know what contingency is coming up tomorrow. And we were low on ammunition. And we knew we were going back in the Gulf. We didn't know for how long. And so Harry, by that time we had changed operational control to CTF-77, more on Ticonderoga. And he said he wanted to refuel and rearm before we went back up there. Not only a logical request, but an absolutely necessary request. And 77 had it. We went alongside an oiler. I don't remember which. Maybe we even refueled in the carriers. I don't remember. Both ships refueled. And Maddox refueled, and this is an unusual thing, destroyer from Samuel Moore, as I recall. We took some of their ammunition, their 5-inch 38 ammunition. Our normal administrative commander was a gentleman named Groverman. Rear Admiral Groverman.
Groverman?
Yeah. He's sitting on his butt in Sasebo, Japan. No doubt at the officer's club, with all of its amenities, while we're in the middle of this stuff. And because he's our administrative boss, he gets copied too on a lot of these messages. And in response to our request to stay out of the Gulf for the couple of hours it would take to refuel and rearm, he sends a scathing message. I don't remember if it was personal or not, but he sent a scathing message to Harry saying that that request was not in conformance with the traditions of the spoiler, or words to that effect. The scathing attack on Harry. My first CO on Pritchett, second CO actually on Pritchett, my tour before this was, CO was a guy named Corliss Nugent, and by that time he'd become the ops officer for Crew Desk Block 3, who was Scroger. And I ran into him in an old club sometime later, and he and I had a conversation about that message. I mean, it was just terrible. And then after all this was over, you know, then we get around to talking about medals and awards, all of which were downgraded, at least automatically downgraded, at least one step. And there weren't that many, really, were there? And you can confirm this with one Captain Kelly. He used to write extensively for the Proceedings, lives in San Diego. He had a cruiser, he had a squadron, as I recall. And he worked at Personnel Support Activity in San Diego. I think his first name is Jim, as I recall. Wouldn't be that hard to run down.
K-E-L-L-Y or E-Y?
I don't know if Y or E-Y. But he was the destroyer squadron ops officer at the time. The way we were organized then was a squadron commander and a division commander. The division commander worked for the squadron commander. The division kept the, in this case, it was 19. Does Ron 19 also own Does Div 191, and then you had another captain who served as Commodore for 192, which was our case. And he was the squadron ops officer, I was the division ops officer, and he told me, don't even write a medal recommendation up to Commodore Herrick. We don't even want to see it. Commodore Herrick subsequently went at some innocuous job at Mechanicsburg or some shore job, and then he went to the Naval Ammunition Depot at in Portsmouth, Virginia. CO, and as I recall, he was told to retire and to get out of his house at short order. He had a base house, and he was just treated horribly. No excuse for that. And all I can figure is because, you know, some of the messages he sent, some of which I had a hand in, were what would now be termed politically incorrect. But all he did was reporting what he saw and his judgment of his on-scene commander.
He was being pressed immediately to verify, because Johnson needed ammunition to go before the American people, and he wasn't responding the way they wanted to.
Let me speak to that. I don't know what Johnson and McNamara's perception of how fast he can respond is, but as soon as we were told to do this, those of us who thought that we could provide proof, and as I recall, Herrick did not write one of these, but I did. There were four or five of us, maybe more. And again, now we had time, so these were top secret messages, so you encrypt them. It takes a long time. But all of us wrote our, why we thought it happened, and you know, I don't remember what I wrote. It probably is very similar to what I've just said about the sequence of events. And then I had to encrypt it all. And then it went off. And how many communications channels and through what, how many comm stays, I don't know. But I will say that after we were told to do it, there wasn't anybody saying, well, I'll take a nap first. We understood the criticality of the timing of it, and we did it immediately. So that's the first time I've heard that, but you know, it's just another unfair criticism of the on-scene command.
And you had been initially put in for a Bronze Star, and that was downgraded to
at the first level, as I recall. I don't remember.
But still, you ended up getting
which
was the only one awarded. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't remember. The two COs were both put in for Silver Stars, and they were both downgraded to Bronze Stars. It was almost like it was a rank pecking order.
Okay, I see. And was your action was a result of your position? How is it that you came to be awarded this or put in for this level of combination?
Well, you'd have to ask Commodore Herrick. I was in a lot of places doing a lot of things at a lot of, and probably performing on a level not expected of a lieutenant junior grade. And I can almost say that I got no sleep at all for 8 days.
Herrick, Commodore Herrick, any other way that he was chastised you can think of off the top of your head?
Well, the message from Groverman,
mm-hmm.
he was totally out of favor with the whole surface warfare community. It was like he was the other end of the spectrum from John Paul Jones, like he was a coward or like he'd done something wrong. And even with the benefit of all this hindsight, you know, I don't think he did anything wrong.
Even at the time, you thought he acted, performed
exactly. The only thing that I would have differed on him was that I think that one message at the end of the night of the 4th of August conveyed, as I recall the message, it probably conveyed doubt on the whole thing rather than it should have conveyed doubt on some starting point away from the actual start of the thing. That's the only place I would have differed.
Okay.
Some of the messages and some of the language and some of the messages was in the heat of battle, and a lot of that's attributed to me. If I could see all those messages now, and I don't remember them all. But maybe it was language that I used that hurt him. I don't know.
Which mostly would have had to do with heading towards sea, flank speed to buy more time before the attacks?
Yeah, I think there was an impression. There was an impression, and I got, you know, this is gained from talking to people in O clubs, and talking to people over the years about the event. I think there was a widespread impression that instead of rearing up, if you will, and meeting the enemy head on, that he ran away from it. Well, it's ridiculous. So if your ship goes 30 knots, and he's starting 5-6 miles away, and he can go 50 knots, running into any good for starters. And it is clearly realized today. All we were doing is trying to buy time to let the world know. And those were in the days of what would now be considered archaic communication methods. It was buy time, let the world know what's going on, and then fight. And once we decided to fight, once we fired those warning shots and they didn't. Let me say something about warning shots. Because I know there's some question, and there's been question over the years, lawyers question whether warning shots are legal or not, and I guess I understand the question, but let me just say mariners understand warning shots. I mean, they've been around since the days of the Barbary pirates or whatever. Lawyers may not understand them, and they can argue them all forever, but mariners understand warning shots. Those were warning shots. Considerable, a number of mils of offset put into weapons, and there was a big delay between those three shots and opening fire for effect.
And a good mariner is clearly going to understand them to be warning shots.
Absolutely.
Would you consider the North Vietnamese good mariners?
Well, I don't know that, but the fact that we fired and then we didn't fire again for an interval, you know, you'd have to be an idiot to think that, you know. Ships don't fire at each other for no reasons at all. We fired in their direction, but was offset well ahead of them. And they saw those splashes, and they must have understood, we considered, that if they continued on their course of action, that we considered it would be hostile.
The next day you went, you ordered back into the area to look for debris, pick up debris, and none was found. What do you think?
I will just say that the fact that we found no debris doesn't really, I don't draw any conclusions from that. Navigational accuracy in those days was not what it is now by a long shot. We might not have been, and what do we have to go on? After it's all said and done, we got this long DRT track. Paper kept being changed, and I don't think people were being very, it wasn't my job, it was an OS's job, but to be very diligent about labeling things on that DRT track. And the quartermaster who could have or should have or whatever been keeping a log of our navigational position at certain times might have been worried about other things at the time. Well, I'm not even confident that we went back and searched in the same area. In the same area, yeah, but the small debris in the water, such as if you got a direct hit and blew a boat up, that's all you're going to get is small debris. And you're going to have to be within a mile or less to see it. I mean, it was, and I don't recall there having been any search, much less a concentrated search by aircraft. Those are the guys who can do it. They can cover a large area They're looking down on the water in the daytime. They can see it a lot better than they can from eye level on the bridge. So I draw no conclusion from that at all.
You weren't. I was struck by the amount of time you spent in the area. It didn't seem to me like it was that long to be doing any kind of search. I believe you got there late in the morning and left one or two in the afternoon. It was 2 or 3 or 4 hours you were doing a search. Do you think that would have been enough time, unless you came right upon it?
Probably not. We probably only really covered a couple of square miles. And the inaccuracies of navigation and the confusion of the night, again. And remember, this is a running battle. It took place over 2 hours. It's not 60 miles worth of track, because there's a lot of zigging and zagging going on in there. But it's certainly 30 to 40 miles worth of track. And for the couple of hours, you can cover that track. But are you displaced off of this track by a couple of miles from where you actually were? I mean, it's certainly within the navigation accuracy of the time.
Because the OS is changing the DRT plot. How long does that take, physically?
Well, they're good at it, a couple of seconds. You're just whipping off one piece of onion skin paper, putting on another, and labeling both papers where one starts and another one stops. That's all.
And if they're conceivably busy doing other things?
I have seen DRTs forever. I mean, you look at a DRT and it'll tell you what your latitude and longitude is. A DRT gets its input from the gyro and from the pit lock. Pit locks. If anyone wants to depend on a pit lock, which is showing you your speed, ostensibly through the water, for a DRT trace, and expect it to be accurate over a long period of time, is nuts. I mean, you'd never rely on a DRT to tell you where you are anymore.
Especially when you're doing zigzag course changes.
Yeah.
So, and then also, it may not have been changed. The OSs are busy too at this time, is that right?
Well, yeah, they're plotting all the contacts they have, and by then, you know, we had multiple contacts. Again, mass confusion, and probably the Maddox CIC officers and ops officers were. Once we told the ship to do their own thing, my primary job then was to tell the rest of the world what was happening to us. And it was, well, ship's ops officers, CIC officers were running operations in there. Which, in one sense, gave me the time to stand back and watch and, not have to be directly involved. But again, I could hear the radio speaker that one of the air control circuits was on. I heard the 29MC with the sonar hypersonic effects.
It seems not inconceivable that a DRT plot running out, if it was 15 seconds, let's say, before it's changed, and you're doing 30 knots.
Well,
how much
just the plot is going to be off. What the instruments on the DRT are going to read is not going to be off. But how often the OSs, for instance, look down and label a point on the DRT paper with our latitude and longitude at that time is questionable to me right now. And the DRT trace, you use that to try and reconstruct what happened. And you use that paper, you have to have, it's got to be labeled frequently enough so that, one, you know where you were, or you can extrapolate that, so that you know where you were at some point, some time. And hopefully there's enough on that plot for you to even then test the accuracy of the whole thing, to see if everything's consistent. I doubt if we had either circumstance.
Would be within reason to say that it might have been a couple miles off?
Absolutely. With the navigational instruments we had in those days, when you're out in open ocean and you can't, if you're not using radar to take fixes with, and I don't think the radar was being used that night to take cuts on Hainan Island. I mean, even then, the further away you are from land, the radar is painting the cliffs so far inland instead of the beach. But the beach is what's shown on your chart that you lay out your dividers from. I mean, there's always a one or two. That's why there's so many visual navigation aids when you go in and out of port. And we had some LORAN coverage in there, but we didn't have satellite navigation, not on Maddox in those days. And there was no way for us to know within 2 miles or 3 miles or maybe more at the time.
Or maybe more.
Where we even started, much less where we ended.
So that's not inconceivable. It's just a lot of people pin a lot on there not being any debris. And the fact is, the chances of you finding it with the assets that you had were slim to start with, even if it was city.
Well, I wouldn't say slim, but on the other hand, that we didn't find any. To me, probably because we weren't where we thought we were. It doesn't mean anything. If we'd have had some P3s, or even, say, a whole day's worth of slow-moving A1s, to do that whole area, and I'm talking now probably about at least 300 square miles. 300 square miles. Something that's 30 miles long and 10 miles wide. Maybe 40 or 50 miles long. That's a big area of ocean to search for small debris. And as I recall, the airplanes did not participate, not to any significant extent, in the search.
They were busy, too, doing other things that day. Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there any way to account, back to on a technical question, the difference between the Maddox and the Turner Joy and what their impressions were, what their sightings were?
There seemed to be a lot more visual stuff and certainty from Turner Joy than the Western Maddox.
A lot more.
A lot more.
How can you account for that?
I can.
They're both using SPS-10, and they're not coming up with
remember, we're not. The stuff, the visual stuff is not dependent. That's what people saw with their eyeballs. Maybe Turner Joy people were just in a better position to see that. Maybe they scored hits on what they were looking at. And Maddox didn't. I don't know.
Well, they had seen it.
And they had a different fire control radar. The weapons officer on the Maddox, as I recall, his name was Connell. He also didn't believe that attack happened. And he was in gunfire, as I recall. And he never saw anything on the fire control. We've got to remember fire control. If this is this whole swath here is a rotating beam of a surface arc radar, okay? Mm-hmm. This is a fire control radar. Not only that, it doesn't just freely rotate. You tell the fire control radar where to go, and then it looks for it. And it's looking down on that water. It's a high frequency, high PRF, and the fact that he says that he never saw anything on his radar. It's like Stockdale saying he didn't, to me, you know, I would have liked for him to see it. I would have liked for him to say he locked up on something. And from hindsight, years later, reading what he said, and I didn't hear that at the time, the weeks afterwards, I wonder what the hell they were shooting at. Because Maddox was clearly shooting. Now, if they didn't have fire control radar contact on something, what the hell were they shooting at?
I think Connell had been told by Osier, I think, over the phone. Osier said, shoot. Connell said, I don't see anything. And he said, we'll shoot something. and I think he put in a start at that time. And then was firing.
Well, yeah, you don't see anything shoot a star shell, but I mean, I think he was shooting.
That's what he started with.
I think
with.
He was shooting BT frag and other stuff, too.
Well, that's why he started with the star shell, because he was told to fire, and he didn't know what to fire because he didn't see anything. So he said, okay, let's send a star shell.
You'd have to ask Osier whether that conversation happened. Mm-hmm. That doesn't sound like a comment a commanding officer should make, because if you say shoot something, it might end up being Turner Joy. So.
Well, apparently that happened too.
I don't put a lot of stock in that story.
Okay. That's
some guy trying to make himself into a hero.
Well, that was...
On the one hand, I say it's a miracle it didn't happen, but to say that it didn't happen because of this one individual is... it's conceivable that happened that night. Again, both ships were operating independently at that point in time. But to me, that what we're saying is that Connell, we would have to say that Connell and his fire control officer and Oger all failed in their duties to check that bearing and make sure current joy wasn't in that bearing before they told him to shoot. Every one of them would have had to make that mistake.
And also
conceivable, yeah, but likely, no.
And also the supporting that, the gunner who was down there, the enlisted man, heard entirely different things. He didn't.
Well, but it was an enlisted guy on a scope that supported, I don't remember his name, that claimed credit for not shooting the return of joy, wasn't it?
One or the other down there, I can't remember who now.
It wasn't Connell.
Somebody gave orders to fire and somebody refused to fire. That's what the book said. And they didn't, and they Dead refused the orders to fire, and then when they did look up, it was the Turner Joy right in their sights. Something to that effect.
Makes a hell of a good story. That guy should have gotten the Silver Star. We should have known about it at the time we read him up. Somebody's embellishing things. I mean,
where's the last you knew of Commodore Harrod? Mechanicsburg?
Or no, when he had put the timeline on here. He left the division and he was relieved by a real gentleman named Petillo. Herrick went, I think that was when he knew. It wasn't necessarily, it was someplace in Pennsylvania. It was a weapons depot in Pennsylvania. And I finished out my tour on 192, and then I went to be an executive officer of the Pledge. That was another 2 years. It was actually quite a period of time, because I made another deployment in 192. We were on the gun line then. We were doing NGFS and everything else the following year in 65. In 68 to 70, I was in Beaufort. And I was the electronics technician and data systems radio control officer. And I was in Beaufort and Herrick called me. Now this is really unusual when a captain calls a lieutenant and asked me for some help with where he was being detailed. And I mean, I was amazed when he called me. Captains don't ask lieutenants to help. And I don't remember what the circumstance is at the time, but I remember left a bad taste in my mouth for how Herrick was being treated, and I just don't remember the circumstances. What he asked me to do, I did. I went over to the captain details section of the bureau, and what I just don't remember the details. I just didn't remember leaving that case in my mind. And then a couple of years later, I think it must have, then I went to PG school, and then I went to the staff college in Norfolk. And I think it must have been when I was in the staff college. That's the only time I was stationed in Norfolk. And he had the ammo depot at St. Julian's Creek, which is in Portsmouth. And my wife and I visited he and his wife there a couple of times while I was at the staff college. And he was relieved of command there, as I recall, retired there. I even remember when he was relieved, and I was amazed he was given like 2 days to get out of his house or something. But it was like this black cloud followed him around from then on, ever since the Gulf of Tonkin. And it just was no reason to be that way. If somebody had sent Herrick a message, somebody with authority, 77, the 7th Fleet, the SINPAC Fleet, to Admiral Sharp, or whomever, to actively seek out and destroy the enemy, he would have done it just as fast as anyone else, and just as well. But that wasn't what we were supposed to be doing.
Okay.
And you've got to remember the mood of the times. I mean, this was right after the Cuban Missile Crisis. This was right after everyone envisioning the world being incinerated, and there was a loose alliance between North Vietnam and Russia and China, closer alliance at the time of China. Over the years, it became closer with Russia, less so with China. But we didn't know, is this the first rung of a ladder that we don't even want to think about the top rung? If he'd known, if he'd known what this was all about, and whatever Washington was trying to accomplish with this, if he'd have known it, whatever it was, and we can all speculate on that, I'm sure he would have acted quite differently, and his messages would have had a different tone. But that just wasn't the case.
Plus,
and I don't think there was any, I don't want to speak for him, but I want to get back to this issue of provocation for a second. Again, other than being told in Taipei to not interfere with 34 Alpha Ops and being told that I was not clear to know what those were that I was not to interfere with, I had no notion, no knowledge, no nothing. And I can say unequivocally, since I had none, that I think the only possible people who could have are Herrick and Oger, because they had equivalent clearances and may have been told more than I, but I don't. I'm relatively certain Oger didn't, less certain that Herrick didn't, but still I'm comfortable that he probably didn't.
And why did you think Herrick may not have known, that he might have known something?
Only because he was very quick and able to identify the Norwegian nasties when we refueled that day and they came out. And that he had a stronger sense of danger on the 31st and the 1st than I had.
With the hostile fishermen, hostile junk?
Just the whole environment up there. It seemed like he... And even from hindsight, I think he anticipated something where I anticipated nothing. Now, maybe that's just because of experience. I don't know. And maybe it's because he had been in combat before in Korea, and I'd never been in combat before.
And in Korea, he'd seen...
Well, he was CO of an LSMR in Korea, so, I mean, he was inshore shooting rockets.
And he had seen North Vietnamese using tactics...
No, I'd seen the North Koreans using tactics of laying dynamite junks alongside. And you know, when he told me that story, and you know, it's just, well, you know, it's interesting, but I'm wondering why he's telling me a story. I don't. We're on an innocent DeSoto patrol. We do these all the time. They might claim territorial waters and tell us to leave, but that's going to be the substance of it. And you know, I was amazed when they attacked us on the 2nd. I wasn't that amazed on the 4th because, you know, if you reach out and try to hit a guy and he gives you a bloody nose, maybe you're going to come back the next day and see if you can give him a bloody nose. I wasn't that surprised on the 4th, but I was really surprised on the 2nd. The hell? And I was very impressed with the courage of those three boats. I mean, Maddox was laying down a very effective and intensive barrage of fire on those boats. It didn't deter them at all. I mean, you had to hit them to stop.
Were you in CIC on the 2nd?
I was. On the night of the 4th, I was almost exclusively in CIC, except for the trip to Radio Center. On the 2nd, a lot in CIC, some in radio, and some on the bridge. But, you know, I'm talking about what I personally observed on the bridge with my eyeballs as far as courage and seeing that one torpedo. Those happened at times I was on the bridge. I probably spent more time on the bridge on the 2nd than I remember I spent now. Because Herrick was up there on the 2nd. And every time I prepared to send a message, I'd go say, I want to send the message that says so-and-so, and he'd say, okay. I mean, we didn't take time to draft messages like we normally do.
And did you see the three boats on the 2nd? Did you see them on the scope?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And that was very much the same thing you saw on the 4th.
Well, radar contacts are radar contacts
and
radar contacts.
The SPS
unless it's fuzzy and to poke a little fun at these guys, it's birds, maybe pelicans look different than seagulls. I don't know. I'm not an expert on birds on radar. I can tell you that as far as I know, after 30 years of Navy experience and 15 years at sea and
self-professed expert on command and control. Well, not just self-professed, but on radar systems and command and control systems. I don't think I have ever seen a bird on the Red Hawk. I don't think I ever have. But for those people who think they have, you know, I'll give them that. It's just something I've missed. When we were finally told what 34 Alpha Ops were on the 5th, you know, it was like all of a sudden this big jigsaw puzzle just came, boom, right into place.
And you could understand how the North Vietnamese might have put the two together.
Absolutely. They were defending their homeland, or however you want to phrase it. There was no question in my mind, since we were told that there was an attack on the night of the 1st, in the vicinity of Hanmei, and, you know, to me, you know, I tried to put myself in their shoes. They get rocketed or whatever from the sea, 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, whenever it was, but it wasn't the middle of the night. And when the sun comes up the next day, they see a U.S. Navy destroyer sitting there. What the heck? You know, what conclusion are you going to draw? That if he didn't do it, he was supporting those that did. And we've got to show them that we're not going to tolerate that. And now whether the order to attack us was issued from Uncle Ho or Jop, the defense minister, or from some local naval commander, I have no idea. I mean, it makes no difference. They came out and attacked us because they had been attacked, and as far as they were concerned, they were provoked. As far as I'm concerned, they were provoked. The fault for this whole thing, which I would remind the listener or reader, was the genesis. I'm not saying that absent this, there never would have been some other genesis. This was the genesis of our involvement in Vietnam. Lost my train of thought there for a second. But it was provoked. We provoked it. Maddox didn't deliberately and knowingly provoke it. I don't blame the North Vietnamese. For Lyndon Johnson to tell the American people it was an unprovoked attack, and based on the State Department stuff I've read and other National Security Council stuff you provided me here, it's obvious that they were having discussions then that indicate they felt the North Vietnamese felt they were provoked, and the North Vietnamese linked the two events. And they were having the president was having these discussions with McNamara and others before he told the American people it was unprovoked. And so it was just another case of the government misleading the American people. This one had tragic consequences. Again, maybe there would have been some other reason we'd have gone to North or into Vietnam. But this was the reason. This was the excuse. The Tonkin Gulf Resolution gave him a free hand. Down the road we went.
As you pointed out in our first correspondence, Geoff, in his recent meeting with McNamara, and that was the only question McNamara asked about the Vietnam War, and Geoff denied that the attack took place on the 4th. Why would he do that? What would he have to gain by doing that now?
I don't, you know, I'd have to, just be pure speculation that he didn't want to acknowledge that they did something to provoke us into the both the 5th, the attack, our retribution on the 5th, and the Tonkin Gulf Resolution. Other than that, I don't know why he would do that. But for McNamara to act like, you know, for him to now say that it was all a mistake, and, you know, we should have known that at the time, I suppose. Hindsight's always 20/20. But McNamara clearly knew. From what I knew then and from what I've reviewed now, McNamara knew at the time, Johnson knew at the time, Senator Morse knew at the time, and he was the only one speaking with clarity then. You know, if we're going to go to North Vietnam to save the world from communism, we subscribe to the domino theory, and that's what we're going to do, and tell the American people that's what we're going to do. Tell them the truth. The only questions in my mind about it, there are 3 points that I really want to underscore here. The first is, actually 2 points are that
were 34 Alpha Ops and Maddox operations, I've wondered about this over the years. I don't have any wonder today, but I did over the years. Were they kind of accidentally married together? Was somebody at a high level who knew about both operations careless? Or did somebody at a high level that knew about both operations just wasn't able to see the risk of putting these types of operations in proximity and time and place? In other words, was it a careless mistake of some kind? Or were they deliberately married in order to hope, to provoke, and to hope that the North Vietnamese did something like this, which then could be turned around to mold American public opinion to pursue a foreign policy which the administration wanted to pursue? Based on the stuff that I've read today at these National Security Council meetings, other stuff that you provided me, and I lean very heavily, if not unequivocally, toward the latter. The third point that I want to make is that, and it's going to tie back into some of the things I said about Commodore Herrick. American sailors, soldiers, Marines, whatever, we were trained to fight, and we were prepared to die if necessary. I saw no lack. I didn't see overt heroism in the Gulf during that period of time. I did not see any cowardice in the Gulf at that time. Those people who think that Maddox opened a range initially, or at least avoided action initially in both cases, on the second, we bought time. On the fourth, we turned away from this in order to get this so-called air cover we always had, which we didn't have. I mean, they can write volumes about the air cover we had. It was sporadic at best. We bought time to get air support up there. And any commander who was so worried about being called a coward by some of his people sitting in bars somewhere in front of a fireplace smoking a cigar away from the action, is so worried about their perception that he does not take the opportunity to bring maximum force to bear in his favor, is not a professional. And that's all Herrick did. He wanted to get maximum force to bear. Nothing to do with being afraid of anything. Any commander, whether he's the civilian president of the United States, or he's the four-star SINCPAC or SINCPAC fleet, or the three-star Comp 7 fleet, who sends naval forces in harm's way without giving them adequate preparation of the risk on the risks they face and adequate support, is also not professional. And we had all of that. And of course, all those non-professional people are the ones that criticized Herrick for not being professional. And I am bitter today. I was bitter then. I will remain bitter that Maddox and then Turner Joy were essentially left hung out to dry up there, and there was, as I told you before, there was every indication, including indications from the intelligence centers in Washington, that we were going to be attacked. And I don't remember now whether it was the 8th or the 9th. It was the last day, and we were scheduled to be there. The North Vietnam had just gotten 50 MiGs and 2 Beagles from China with the pilots and the bombs and whatever. And every indication was we were going to be attacked with those MiGs, those Beagles, and every PT boat they had left. And we just wouldn't have been able to withstand it. We didn't have a missile destroyer up there. These are old World War II guns. Well, Turner Joyce was better. But they're old gun systems. There's just no way we could have withstood that. And Commodore Herrick and I, the people who were aware of the intelligence reports, I will tell you that at 4 o'clock that morning, those officers who were not on watch were... One was...